So turn again to Genesis chapter 6, verses 13 to 30. So chapter 6 has begun with that exciting word, now. But the Lord said to Moses, now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh. And as readers of Exodus coming to this passage that we're looking at this morning then, we're thinking this must be the one. This must be where it happens. We're about to see now Yahweh spring into action and do his stuff on Pharaoh. And so we start making ourselves comfortable and reaching for the popcorn and rubbing our hands with glee at the drama that's about to unfold. And we read verse 13. But the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron and gave them a charge about the people of Israel and about Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt. Well, that doesn't exactly set the world alight, but that's okay. It's only a kind of introductory verse. It will be in verse 14, surely, that things really hot up. And so we carry on into verse 14 and we read, these are the heads of their fathers' houses, the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, Hanok, Palu, Hezron, and Carmi. These are the clans of Reuben. That's not exactly what we were expecting. That's not an account of Yahweh setting to work on the obstinate Pharaoh. That is a genealogy. What the dickens is a genealogy doing here? Well, that's the question that I want us to ask and answer this morning. What is this genealogy doing here? And I want to suggest that the answers to that question are to be found in the verses around the genealogy, which also form part of our passage this morning. And I have then three answers to this question. What is this genealogy doing here? First, it fits with the refrain. That's my first answer. It fits with the refrain. And the refrain to which I'm referring is the one that occurs three times in the verses surrounding the genealogy. That line about bringing out the people of Israel from Egypt. It's there in verse 13, it's there in verse 26, and it's there in verse 27. There are minor variations in terms of the order of the words and such like, but it's basically the same line in each case. And it creates a sense of God passionately determined to redeem Israel. I mean, it's almost gong-like in its repetition. Bring out the people, bring out the people, bring out the people. There's a momentum about it that kind of makes the hairs on the back of your neck stand on end. It fills you with this excited feeling. Yahweh is coming for his people and nothing and no one is going to stop him bringing them out of Egypt. Or at least the refrain would have that kind of momentum about it, and it would fill you with that kind of feeling were it not for this unfortunate chunk of genealogy interrupting things, stuck bang in between occurrence one and occurrence two of the refrain. It spoils the effect completely. It ruins this otherwise powerful recurring expression of God's earnest resolve to rescue his people. What a shame, we say. What a shame that verses 14 to 25 have to be there. Well, I want you to see that that's a wrong way to view this genealogy. The genealogy doesn't undermine or weaken the refrain. On the contrary, it fits with the refrain. It complements it perfectly. Let me show you why I say that. I want you to notice the time frame of this genealogy, the period that it covers. Basically, it's the period that the Israelites are in Egypt. So the earliest participants in the genealogy are Reuben, Simeon, and Levi, featured there in verses 14 to 16. And they, of course, were the generation that went from Canaan down to Egypt. You remember how Exodus began? These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and so it goes on. So that's where our genealogy here begins, at the start of the Israelites' period in Egypt. You go to the other end of this genealogy, and it concludes with Phinehas, who is Aaron's grandson. And given that Aaron is 83 at the time that the Exodus takes place, it seems likely that Phinehas is at that point either a child or soon to be born. So you can see then that the genealogy basically stretches from the start of Israel's time in Egypt to the end of Israel's time in Egypt. So what, you say? Well, it means that what the genealogy is doing is this. It's putting some names to the Israelites who endured the period in Egypt. So far, we haven't been given any names, or we've been given hardly any, just those two midwives, Shiphrah and Puah. Apart from that, it's been very clinical and impersonal. The people of Israel multiplying, the people of Israel being made slaves, the people of Israel groaning. Even Moses' own parents and sister weren't actually named when they appeared in the narrative. And names make a difference, don't they? You think of a war memorial. And it's one thing, isn't it, to have studied the 20th century's two world wars at school or at university, and to know the statistics, the numbers of the soldiers who died. It's another thing altogether, on visiting some town or village, to go and look at the war memorial in that place, and read the names, and alongside the names, the ages, perhaps, of the soldiers who died. That brings it home, doesn't it? That those dead soldiers in World War I and World War II weren't statistics. They were real persons taken from the quiet streets in which you are now standing and sent to the trenches or wherever. Real persons whose final weeks and months would have been a prolonged nightmare of gunfire and explosions and fear and exhaustion and hunger and seeing friends die and countless other horrors besides. I'm saying these memorials evoke a feeling in a way that statistics and nameless data cannot. They make us shudder. We start to well up and we say those wars, they truly were wretched things. And this genealogy then, it's like a war memorial. It personalizes the people of Israel there in Egypt. And in doing so, it reflects, I think, God's own perspective. The point is that as those years and decades and centuries go by, and as after a while things start to get really, really tough for the Israelites in Egypt, God doesn't look down from heaven and see this impersonal entity there, this undifferentiated mass of suffering Hebrews. No, he sees Mali and Mushi, verse 19. He sees Mishael, Elzaphan, and Sithri, verse 22. He sees real persons in all their individuality. He sees what being a slave in Egypt means for each one of them. He sees the particular toll that the whole thing is taking on particular lives. And now perhaps you're starting to see how the genealogy then fits with the refrain. The refrain, we said, expresses God's passionate determination to redeem Israel. Well, far from being a cold, sterile list which interferes with that expression of divine determination, the genealogy is actually of a piece with it. The genealogy shows us what fuels God's passion to redeem his people. His people is a company of individuals, each of whose names and situations he's profoundly aware of. That's what fuels his passion to redeem. His knowledge of his people, name by name, person by person, individual by individual. And you know, if that is true in God's redemption of his people from Egypt, it's true at a whole other level when it comes to God's ultimate redemption of his eternally elect people from sin and Satan's bondage. What fuels his passion to accomplish it? What fuels Jesus as he strides unswervingly toward the cross where he will obliterate his people's guilt and break his people's chains? What fuels him is his knowledge of his people. Name by name, person by person, individual by individual. Do you remember how in Revelation 21, 27, we're told, aren't we, that Jesus has a book? More than that, in his capacity as the Lamb, that is the one who sacrificed himself at Calvary, he has a book, the Lamb's Book of Life. And it's clear in that verse that this is not a storybook or a picture book. It's more like a directory, a list, because that verse speaks of those who are written in it. It's a list of those for whom he is the sacrificial lamb at Calvary. I read an interview recently with Rachel Harrison. Rachel Harrison is the owner of Walwick Hall, a hotel that's out sort of Hexham way. And at one point in the interview, she was describing her daily routine and how it begins with her touching base with the breakfast team at the hotel. And then when the guests are having their breakfast, she goes around the tables chatting to them about their plans for the day. And then she said this, "From there, I meet with the duty manager to ensure we know who is arriving that day and make sure we have everything in order that caters to the guest's specific needs. This is one of the most important things we do to prepare for a guest's arrival. We take our time on this and make sure things like birthdays and favourite wines are not overlooked. We usually have notes of this on file from previous stays or through our correspondence before a guest visits." She continues, "We're a boutique hotel, and so it's these small touches that really set us apart from others, and remembering these little details is something I've paid particular attention to when developing the brand." It isn't like that when you turn up at a travel lodge, is it? There you tell the receptionist your reference number, and you hope that the internet booking has worked properly, and you come up somewhere on the database as she types into the computer. At Walwick Hall, on the other hand, the owner knows all the names on the guest list, and who these people are, and where they're coming from, and the purpose of their stay, and the particular needs that they have. And I'm saying then, when we think of Jesus going to the cross of Calvary, we shouldn't have in our minds the travel lodge scenario. His Book of Life, just this clinical database comprising loads of reference numbers. I need to die for number 5083, and I need to die for number 88237, and so on. No, we should have in our minds the Walwick Hall scenario. And like Rachel Harrison with her guest list, Jesus has studied that Book of Life. And he knows every name in it. He knows the particular burden of guilt that each one has. He knows the particular pain that Satan's dominion has inflicted in each case. And driven by that detailed knowledge, he throws himself into Calvary's momentous undertaking. Isn't that a precious thought? That to Jesus, you are not a statistic on his salvation register. You're a Libni, or a Shimei, in verse 17 of our passage. You're a name that he was reciting to himself as the nails were being hammered in. You're an individual he specifically wanted and planned to save that day. You were on his mind at Golgotha. You were on his heart. You can say with Paul, "He loved me and gave himself for me." What a thought. Our God doesn't save a constituency, a class, a subdivision. He saves persons, you and me, him and her, this person and that person. Revel in the wonder of that. Our God saves persons. And so that's the first thing then that I want you to see about this genealogy. It fits with the refrain. But then notice with me, secondly, it sets up the joke. It sets up the joke. Look at verses 26 and 27. And there's an emphasis there that you can't possibly miss. "These are the Aaron and Moses, to whom the Lord said, 'Bring out the people of Israel from the land of Egypt by their hosts.' It was they who spoke to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, about bringing out the people of Israel from Egypt. This Moses and this Aaron." Now, suppose the genealogy were different. Suppose that, like Matthew's famous genealogy, it had a very careful, mathematically precise structure. Suppose it had, for the sake of argument, four distinct sections, each comprising four names. So there are names 1 to 4, and then there are names 5 to 8, and then there are names 9 to 12, and then there are names 13 to 16. But then right at the end, and dramatically violating the sequence, there are two more names, Aaron and Moses. I mean, that would be powerful. It would be the literary equivalent of a spotlight in a stage production. It would cause all the other names in the genealogy to be plunged into darkness as those two, Aaron and Moses, were brightly illuminated, highlighted for all to see. And that emphasis in verses 26 and 27 would then make sense. These are the Aaron and Moses to whom the Lord said, .. It would flow very naturally if, as I say, the genealogy had thrust Aaron and Moses into center stage. But it's not like that. Some of you will remember Trigger Happy TV. It was a program in which the comedian Dom Jolly would go around performing various pranks, either on or in the presence of unsuspecting members of the public. And there was one he would do that went like this. There would be a public toilet, and Dom Jolly would wait for someone to go into this public toilet, and as soon as a person had gone in, he and his team would leap into action, setting up a big banner saying, "Congratulations, 1 millionth toilet customer," and standing ready right by the door with trumpets and with a bottle of champagne. And after a couple of minutes then, the person would come out of the toilet and be utterly dumbfounded as trumpets would start to blast and a bottle was thrust in their hands, and this man with a microphone and amplifier boomed out effusive congratulations. And it was all just a bit of silly humour, making a big song and dance about this random person walking out of a public toilet. And it's a bit like that here. I mean, it's not as if Aaron and Moses have dominated this genealogy and it's been all about them. As you read it, they don't appear to stand out in relation to the genealogy's other participants. So that when you get to verse 26 and it says, "These are the Aaron and Moses, ... you feel like saying, "Which Aaron and Moses? Oh, you mean those two guys whose births were mentioned back in verse 20 before the genealogy then carried on as if nothing had happened?" It seems kind of Dom Jolly-like, making a big son and dance after the genealogy about this random pair from somewhere within the middle of the genealogy. The genealogy has presented them as just another couple of names fleetingly mentioned. The reverent tone of verses 26 and 27, "These are the Aaron and Moses," thus seems as ludicrous as the banner, trumpets, and champagne in that television prank. It seems like a joke. And it's meant to. It's meant to. Not because the Bible is in the business of entertainment, but because the Bible is the paragon of effective communication, and sometimes serious points are most effectively communicated through humour. And that's what's happening here. How is it, you ask? This comic device of verses 26 and 27 bigging up this pair of men as though the preceding genealogy had bigged them up, when in fact it hasn't done so at all, what serious points does that communicate? Well, a couple. First, the fact that God uses ordinary people. The fact that God uses ordinary people. Because at the end of the day, Aaron and Moses are just a couple of random names from within this genealogy. There's nothing intrinsically superior or special about them. They are just sons whom Jochebed bore to her husband Amram, the same way as a whole load of other women in this family tree bore sons and daughters to their husbands. If you just read verses 26 and 27, if you just read those verses by themselves, you might think, oh wow, Aaron and Moses must be amazing guys to be so involved in the bringing of Israel out of Egypt. But when you read verses 26 and 27 alongside the genealogy, you chuckle because the genealogy has made so little of them, and you say, oh, I get it. The bringing of Israel out of Egypt had nothing to do with Aaron and Moses being amazing guys. Rather, it has everything to do with Yahweh being an amazing God. It isn't that the human agents of the Exodus were the kind of outstanding specimens who only arise once in a millennium in the human race. They weren't. They were ordinary men, like everyone else listed in our passage. It's that the divine agent of the Exodus is so magnificently powerful and wise. That's why the Exodus happened. And you know, it's the same with all the great moments in the Bible and throughout church history. They are never explained by the greatness of the humans involved. Always by the greatness of the God involved. It's the 2 Corinthians 4:7 principle. The surpassing power belongs to God, Paul says, and not to us. Those are 10 words to absorb into your bloodstream. So that on the one hand, in days when the church is full of able people, you won't get drawn into idolatry. And on the other hand, in days when the church is devoid of able people, you won't get drawn into despair. The surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. So that's one thing that this joke is communicating, that God uses ordinary people. But then secondly, and closely related to that, the mysteriousness of God's ways. The mysteriousness of God's ways. We've said that Aaron and Moses aren't much different to all the others in this list. Well, in that case, why them? Why them? Uzziel, for instance, is Amram's brother, verse 18. He, like Amram, has sons, in verse 22. Why don't a pair of them instead become the focal figures of the Exodus? Well, there's only one answer we can give to that, and it's this: we haven't a clue. We haven't a clue. I'm always struck reading the early chapters of the book of Acts by the contrasting fortunes of comparable men. It happens twice there. First, you have Philip and Stephen, and they're both members of the seven chosen to deal with that cross-cultural tension in the Jerusalem church amongst the widows as the food is being distributed. They're both active in preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ in those heady post-Pentecost Jerusalem days. And Stephen is stoned to death by a Jewish mob, while Philip continues his Christian ministry for many years. Then secondly, in those early chapters of Acts, you have Peter and James. James, the son of Zebedee, I mean. They're both members of the original 12 apostles. In fact, they're both members of Jesus' inner circle of three. They're both arrested and imprisoned by Herod. And James is put to death, while Peter experiences an angelic rescue and subsequently enjoys a long ministry. Why? Why not Philip stoned and Stephen spared? Why not Peter executed and James set free in the middle of the night? Again, we haven't a clue. Just like Aaron and Moses becoming the agents of the Exodus rather than any of the other comparable men listed here, it's all a mystery to us. And it reminds us then that God has a plan. And he wasn't obliged to consult us on that plan. And in point of fact, he hasn't consulted us on that plan. And we can't pry into its intricate logic, the rationale behind it taking that turn rather than this turn. And we therefore should adopt the stance of Psalm 131. O Lord, my heart is not lifted up, my eyes are not raised too high. I do not occupy myself with things too great and too marvelous for me, but I have calmed and quietened my soul. That should be our stance. In other words, we should just get on with faithfully serving God each and every day, not worried about comparing my life's path with someone else's life's path. God will take care of all that. The grand plan is his business, not mine. Peter struggled with that, didn't he? You remember how he's there on that beach by the side of the Sea of Galilee, and Jesus has told him what's going to happen to him in the future. And Peter then immediately asks, oh, there's John. What about him? What's going to happen to him? And the reply comes, what is that to you? You follow me. And that's our job. It doesn't matter at the end of the day whether we're sons of Amram or sons of Uzziel. Our job is simply to get on with following Jesus Christ. And so those are two things then that we've seen about this genealogy so far. It fits with the refrain and it sets up the joke. But then notice with me thirdly and finally, it relates to the objection. It relates to the objection. And I mean by that Moses' objection, which he made in last week's passage, but of which we are reminded again in verse 30 of this week's passage, behold, I am of uncircumcised lips. And we talked a little bit about that last week, and we said it reflects Moses' sense of failure. I so failed when I went in and spoke to Pharaoh, I so failed by my words to him to bring about the Exodus as I should have done, that my lips deserve to be struck with divine judgment, the same way my uncircumcised son very nearly was struck with divine judgment. Moses, I think, is saying that. And we said last week he's wrong. That sense of failure is unwarranted. It's because he was expecting the Exodus to happen so quickly and straightforwardly that he has jumped to that conclusion. But I want to say now that in another sense, Moses is right. What I mean is this. As a descendant of Adam, every part of Moses is by nature unclean and unholy and displeasing to God and liable to God's judgment, including his lips. There seems to be some connection here to Isaiah and Isaiah 6. And you remember how he, like Moses, newly commissioned by God for a particular ministry in relation to God's people, cried out, woe is me, for I am a man of unclean lips. And there's no suggestion there that Isaiah has been too hard on himself saying that. Everything points to it being an altogether appropriate response as he's confronted with the revelation of God's awesome holiness. And similarly, here I'm saying at one level, I am of uncircumcised lips is entirely an appropriate thing for Moses to say. Now, I want you to hold that thought and come with me back to the genealogy. And I said that it doesn't end with Aaron and Moses in some very emphatic, spotlighted manner. It just mentions them in verse 20 and pretty much continues. Actually, in relation to Moses, it doesn't even include his children, does it? It does include Aaron's children, however, and it ends then with his son Eleazar and with his grandson Phinehas, as we said earlier. Now, who were those two men, Eleazar and Phinehas? Well, they were Israel's priests. Aaron was Israel's priest. The role should then have passed to his sons Nadab and Abihu, who are mentioned there in verse 23. But of course, as we all know, they transgressed in a very serious manner and were killed by Yahweh. So instead of them, Eleazar becomes Israel's priest, and then after him, Phinehas becomes Israel's priest. And you go to Judges chapter 20, for instance, and Phinehas is mentioned there as being the serving priest where the Ark of the Covenant is at that time. And there's almost a ruthlessness then about this genealogy, as it kind of abandons and overlooks all superfluous data in order to get to these two priests at the end. As I say, Moses' children are overlooked in this genealogy. But he's not the only victim by any means. I mean, at the start of it, you kind of think, don't you, that it's going to go through all 12 of Jacob's sons. Because it begins with the firstborn Reuben, and then it goes to the secondborn Simeon, and then it goes to the thirdborn Levi. But actually doesn't go any further than Levi, because the rest then aren't relevant to the genealogy, and so all the other sons of Jacob are overlooked. And then with Levi's children, there's kind of a token inclusion of Gershon and Merari's immediate offspring, but the real interest is plainly with Kohath's line. And so it goes on. It's breathlessly racing toward these concluding priestly figures. Why? What's the big deal about priests? Well, this is the thing. The role of those priests is to offer blood sacrifices that will solve the problem of Moses' unworthiness and his liability to divine judgment. Well, kind of, anyway. More precisely, they offer blood sacrifices that will anticipate the real solution to Moses' unworthiness and liability to divine judgment. I wonder, have you ever given much thought to Aaron's marriage? Is that something that has kept you awake at night ever in your bed? The matter of Aaron's marriage. Did you even know the name of Aaron's wife? We're told in verse 23, Aaron took as his wife Elisheba, the daughter of Aminadab and the sister of Nashem. And there's something very significant about this marriage, about this wife. Elisheba is of the tribe of Judah. We know that from the genealogies in Matthew 1 and Luke 3, where Aminadab, her father, and Nashon, her brother, are both mentioned. So Elisheba is from the tribe of Judah. What is the tribe of Judah going to be? Well, it's going to be, of course, the royal tribe. That's already been indicated, actually, in the biblical revelation back in Genesis 49, as Jacob is dying. He has mentioned the scepter that's going to be in the hand of Judah. So this marriage, then, in verse 23 of our passage, it's kind of a fusion of priesthood and royalty. And that is a little hint that will gather momentum as the Old Testament proceeds. And in various places, such a fusion crops up. It is a little hint that one day there's going to be a seismic fusion of those two things. The fusion that will take place in Jesus Christ, whose death at Golgotha's cross will be simultaneously a priestly act of atonement and a kingly act of conquest and deliverance. And that then will be the real solution to Moses' problem that he confesses these two occasions in our chapter. I am unclean. I am unworthy. I am liable to judgment. And that's the only real solution to your problem, too. Because it's not just Moses. We said it's all the descendants of Adam who are in this situation of being by nature unclean and unholy and displeasing to God and liable to his judgment. And here lies the answer for every single descendant of Adam. It lies in the fusion of priesthood and royalty that occurred in Jesus Christ and the fusion of priestly work and kingly work that occurred at the cross of Golgotha. Remember there in Isaiah 6 that I referred to just now? There's an answer given there, isn't there, actually, straight away, explicitly, to the problem that Isaiah has confessed of his unclean lips. And the answer is an altar, and a burning coal is taken from that altar. Behold, the voice comes. Behold, this coal from the altar has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away, and your sin atoned for. There's an altar. And there is an altar where you and I can have our uncleanness dealt with. And that altar is the cross of Calvary, where Jesus Christ died. And from that altar, you and I, naturally unclean before God and liable to his judgment, you and I can be cleaned. Cleaned altogether and made worthy in the sight of God. Have you been to that altar? Has that altar been applied to you? Has coal been taken from it and touched your lips and your heart? Come this morning to the altar that is the cross of Jesus Christ and be cleaned before your Maker. Amen. Well, Robert is going to